Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 8, delivered on February 12, 2018. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates.
Today, interest rates. A couple of matters. One quick thing I want to clean up from the last lectures. I went through the idea and the math of an annuity. There's a very special kind of annuity that lasts forever. Now, this one is quite relevant to problems in finance. It's something of a simplistic approach, but it actually works for a lot of the day-to-day pricing we do. In order to do this one, the first thing I want to do is distinguish two types of stock that can be issued by a corporation. Now, the one is probably the one that you would be thinking of when you talk about stock, shares of a stock. That one is your common stock. Common stock is equity. It represents ownership in a firm. If a firm has 1 million shares outstanding, then if you own 100,000 shares, you own 10% of that company. Let me write this down here. Really? That is a slot. Look at that. Okay. Equity. Now, on the one hand, like I said, common stock is the one most people think of when they think of stock. Residual claim to the cash flows of the firm and all of that. In other words, common stock has the claim on the money after the debt holders have been paid in a timely manner. This is the one you will either get a dividend from the company or possibly they'll plow the money back in and your stock price will go up. So, for example, turn on the projector here, and I'll pull up just a quick version of quick stock. You'll see what I'm talking about here. I'll do Netflix, NFLX, pull it up. We'll also have a look at the market in general, see how it's doing right now, how healthy it is. But is that thing going to show? Yeah, I guess it will. I'm going to have to pull down that one window. This time of year, the light begins to really fade everything out. Hang on. Here. Oh, there we go. Like I said, well, first we'll have a quick look at the market and all of that good stuff. Not now. Get off. Okay, finance.yahoo.com. Yahoo.com. Decent day up. You can see that, right? All across the board, there was a pretty good trend, although you'll notice pulling up the Standard & Poor's 500. You can see that the bulls were in charge in the early morning after the bell. And then the bears were in charge. And then the bulls began to have their run. They did what they could, and then it was pretty flat. There was some movement upward, but at the end, you see the sell-off again. Now, that seems to be something that's going on more than unusually right now, is that at the end of the day, there's this sell-off, repositioning. And then, you know, you don't know what's going to go on. But if we look at a 1 month, you can see that there was a rebound over the past couple of days, but it did not overcome the heavy sell-off. And the trend is probably still downward. And I don't have a lot of use for technical analysis, but there's something that I will point out to you. It's what we call declining tops. If you see here, the most recent tops have all been lower. Do you see that downward slope to the tops that is coming along? In other words, we see that the market now has a tendency to be going down. There will be up days, there will be down days, but the down days are going to win over the up days for the time being. And that gives us a sense that, okay, this is probably the first signs of a true bear market. Is it really? We don't know that yet, but those declining tops are a technical tool. The elves, that's what we call the technical analysts, and they, a lot of what they do is voodoo, but this is something that's pretty much clear that this market wants to pull downward. The bulls are fighting back, but overall, this is a losing battle. So this will probably be a trend that will continue. And so we have to recognize that, yeah, it looks like we are in the first round of what will be a long bear market. I'm going to talk about that more in a little bit here. And I'm going to show you something that can tell us possibly if there really is going to be a recession coming up. But that's just a little ways down the line here. Anyway, let me go over here to Netflix, NFLX, for lack of any greater creativity right now. Is there some reason that sucked? Okay. I want Netflix. NFLX. And I am not see. Oh, there we go, finally. Okay, the price you see here is the price of a share of common stock. This is the common equity of the corporation. Now, as you can see with Netflix, Netflix does not pay a dividend, so they're plowing all of the residual cash flow back into the corporation. The shareholders are getting nothing in terms of a dividend. Notice, as far as the risk of this stock in a well-diversified portfolio, what do you see?
Highly risky.
It's pretty risky. I mean, this is still within the normal range of a portfolio addition. But unless you're a risk taker, this has about 1.5 times the volatility in a well-diversified portfolio of the market itself. So this one's going to swing hard. Oh, holy. Okay. Look at that PE ratio on that thing. That is a really high, even in this era. Remember I told you, back in my time, we would have worried about a PE ratio of 30 to 50. Now you don't bat an eye at that, but that one is nosebleed. Again, let me repeat this for you. That PE ratio, that price to earnings ratio, represents what prospective equity investors are willing to pay to claim $1 of current earnings. I will in a minute. It represents what prospective equity investors are willing to pay to claim $1 of current earnings. Put another way, this is what the market assesses $1 of current earnings they would claim will turn into in earnings they can claim down the road. In other words, in this case, they're saying that $1 that Netflix earned in its last earnings of $1 per share, that belongs to the shareholders who buy the stock or own the stock, that will turn into $206 of earnings they can claim in the future as a present value. That's a lot. I mean, $1 turning into $1 you can claim now by having a share of stock will turn into, as a present value, $206 that you could earn down the road. That's lottery ticket material. Go.
How far down the road?
Well, that's where we get to that perpetuity concept. This is the forever stream of future earnings telescoped back to the present time. In other words, the assumption would be that once you become a shareholder, you'll stay a shareholder, or someone will, with that share of stock. And so down the road, this $1, I latch on to this, that will turn into $206 as a present value of an annuity. That's a good point, though, because that represents that concept of the perpetuity. It's an eternal cash flow. Remember I told you the first part of the early in the course, corporations live forever, theoretically. They don't have a death time like we do, like mortals do. So in other words, if we're talking about a cash flow claim, that would be an eternal cash flow claim because the corporation won't die, at least theoretically. That is just... really? And this thing, 1 year estimate on that was 265. That's really not a very impressive look at that. 1 year down the road, if I wanted to take the 1 year return to an investment, you do the 265, 27, minus the current price. What was that current price again? $257.95 over, the $257.95. To remember that thing. You notice that I do this formula all the time. End minus beginning over beginning. That's how you calculate a percentage. It's kind of odd that when I was a math teacher for years and years, I really never taught this formula, and I never emphasized how important it is in business and in physics and even chemistry and biology. But that's the formula, N minus begin over begin. And let me crank that real quick for you. I'm actually curious now myself. That would be what, 265.27. 265.27 less 257.95, close the parentheses, divided by the 257.95. That's a 2.84% return. That's not for a beta that high. I mean, that's way below market performance. And yet the beta is up there in the stratosphere, and they're not paying a dividend, so it's all reinvestment. So the question would be, WTF? Being very formal about it. Beta high, PE ratio sky high, no dividend, and yet the projection here is that this son of a dog is going to return only 2.84% on an annual for a 1 year holding period. Now, the reason I'm talking like this to you is because I want you to get to the point where you can make this kind of an assessment yourself, just these basic ideas. This is not as far as I'm concerned, I would shy away from an investment like this. Buy something that has real high risk in a well-diversified portfolio, has a ludicrous price-earnings ratio, and yet the projection is I'm going to make only 2.84% on that. I could buy a lottery ticket and be a little happier on something like that. So that's a little concern to me. And I'm going to do this over and over in this class to give you that idea of how you react, how you think about stocks and returns and the numbers that are there. Yeah, not using your gut so much as using the quantitatives, which is what we have to do in business, especially to cover our butts on things. Now, getting back to the main point that I was doing here, that's common stock. That's what you usually see when you think of stock and all that. So now the question, the burning question here is, what's this other thing? It's called preferred stock. It is equity. And I don't want you to distinguish it from common stock that way. There's debt, there's equity. So equity actually has three parts. Internally generated, which you make that belongs to the shareholders, this common stock, the externally generated equity, and this preferred. Now, a little background on this. Preferred stock used to be fairly typical. It was a normal part of what companies used to raise money. They'd issue common stock, they'd issue preferred stock. And there were investors who actually preferred preferred stock, if you will. And the reason they did was it's a very safe kind of stock. Now, understand how preferred stock works. And I'm going to just write a stock here. ACC preferred, 1.5% cumulative preferred par value. Let's say $40 per share. That's how you would see it. And the stock certificate would say this. Preferred stock has some of the flavor of a bond. You see that 1.5%? That means that you, if you own one of these preferred shares, you will every year get a check for $6. You will get it if the company can pay it. If the company cannot pay it, this is cumulative, so it cannot pay the shareholder, the common stockholders, a dividend until it catches up with its preferred dividends. Again, let me say it. Go.
Why is it $6?
Is it? I'm just testing your ass. Yeah. I so suck at math. Ruin more people's lives with my investments. Now that you've made an ass of me here. it is 60 cents. You'll get that check. And if you don't, it's cumulative, so they got to catch them up. And until they catch them up, they can't pay the common shareholders a dividend. So you're in an interesting position because your claim overrides is higher than these common stockholders' claim to dividends. Now, watch out. If I ask you something on a test, hint, hint, about who has the prior claim and who has the residual claim, don't say the prior claim belongs to the debt holders and the preferred shareholders. That's not true. The debt holders have the prior claim. The residual claim is the equity holders, common and preferred. Within that residual claim, preferred comes first, and then comes the common. But don't say preferred is part of the prior claim. It's not. It's part of the residual claim, but it just has a higher, it's higher in its claim than the common. I want to make sure because I've had that, and I try when I see exams over many years and I see a similar mistake, I try to flag it. Don't do that. So take that in mind when I warn you about something like this. Okay, now, preferred stock is very attractive, or at least historically, it was attractive as a fixed income investment, simply because it had more of a guarantee than buying common stock. It was, you got your check. If you didn't, well, that company better catch up with it, especially with cumulative. But interestingly, in our time, preferred has lost a lot of its luster. I mean, it's just like, there are companies that still issue it. If you were to search for preferred, and that usually has a trading symbol with a dot P on it, trading symbol with a dot P, that's preferred, you would find that real estate investment companies tend to be the most likely that you would find with preferred. I was looking for preferred a few years ago. Well, let me show them a few preferred stocks. You don't find them except in fairly tight sectors. They just don't show up that much. Now, here's the other odd thing about it. About a couple of years ago, I took the finance club students up to a couple places in Chicago. One of them was it's an interesting place because what they do is they design packages, portfolios, that they then sell to brokers to use for their clients. So in other words, well, we've got this package of high-risk stocks. Okay, we'll put that together. Now, brokers can use this, and for their high-risk clients who prefer high-risk, they can just sell them this package, this index thing. And they have them all over the place, all kinds of products that they make. Now, the financial engineering designers of these packages, they were talking about, well, you know, we've got a lot of people, they want low risk, but they want equity, and so they want dividends, not growth of the stock. And so we have to do a lot of modeling to find common stocks that pay high dividends and don't grow very fast but are fairly low betas. And he said during the question and answer period, I raised my hand. I said, oh, why aren't you using preferred stock? And he looked at me like I said, why don't you eat a turd sandwich? It was like, why would I do that? Because that's exactly what you're talking about in that portfolio. Oh, well, we just don't do it that way. In other words, you go five times around the barn to get to the outhouse when there's an indoor toilet right there by the back door. It's fallen out of favor. The preferred companies don't issue it, and investors don't think of using it very much anymore. And yet, by the way, preferred stock does not have a growth path. On its price. It's going to forever float around its par value. Here's why. And it goes to a formula that I haven't shown you yet. There, when you're doing annuities, the formula, the actual formula for an annuity is pretty daunting. It's a nice little algebra pain in the backside. Oddly, though, remember that companies live forever. Here we have a kind of stock that gives a guaranteed, no question about it, dividend of the same amount every year forever. That's called a perpetuity. A perpetuity is a level ordinary annuity with an infinite cash stream. A perpetuity is an ordinary level annuity with an infinite cash stream. It just goes on forever and ever. Madam, you buy one of those preferred share, it will pay a dividend to you until the day you die, and then it'll just keep paying a dividend to your heirs and to their heirs, and forever and ever, it'll just keep paying. Forever. That is almost the class, I mean, that's the classic example of a fixed income investment. You see, when you buy a bond, that's fixed income too, because you get the same coupon every year for the life of the bond. But then the bond matures, and then you have to reinvest to keep the ball rolling. With a share of preferred stock, it just keeps doing it. You don't have to, well, it matured, so I have to take the cash and reinvest it in bonds at whatever the price, or whatever the coupons are. This doesn't work that way. It just keeps going. Now, there are all kinds of weird twists on preferred stock, and I'm going to mention a few twists on both common and preferred stock here in a minute. But here's the formula for a perpetuity. The price right now, that's the present value of an infinite cash flow that is level and ordinary, in other words, you get them at the end of each period, is simply the dividend divided by the market's discount rate. Now, this is where interest rates come in. Because as interest rates go up and down, the price of the stock will waver, will swing back and forth. Because this R here is what the market thinks the risk level of this particular investment is, given the overall interest environment. So let me show you something interesting here. For this stock right here, this ACC 1.5% cumulative preferred, par value $40. What we would do is, let's say that the market says that this stock, this preferred stock's risk level is commensurate with, let's say, a 1.2%. So the formula would say that the price right now is that dividend of 60 cents divided by 0.012. And that'll come out to be a number above $40, I hope. Point 0.60 divided by 0.012 should come out $50. And if you think about it, that kind of makes sense because the market's saying that this, right now, that share of preferred should pay a 1.2% dividend, but forever it's going to pay a 1.5% dividend. So it's going to value a little on the high side. Its price will be a little high. By the way, preferred is pretty easy to price. There are some stocks, preferred and common, that are not that hard to price out. And so you can look at minor deviation in the price and see if there's a play for an arbitrage. Usually there's not. Let's say, though, that in a later time, the market says, things are getting a little bit scary out there, so we think that this preferred stock should pay a dividend of 1.75%. In other words, the market is saying the yield is 1.75%. In this case, the price right now of that common of that preferred share would be $0.60 divided by 0.0175. Now we'll see here that the price is going to be on the low side, below the par. In this case, 0.6 divided by 0.0175, survey says, whoa, $34.29. So the market's punishing the stock right now. In the first case, the market loved the stock. Investors are pouring in because it pays more than it should. And in the second case, the market doesn't like this stock. There's going to be a sell-off of the stock because the dividend is not as good as what the market says it should be. Now, notice, by the way, right in the middle, if the market says that it should pay 1.5%, which is what it does pay, the price will be 0.60 over 0.015, and that I don't even need to calculate. The security will sell at par, yeah. No. A good point. Interestingly, there are some preferreds that are indexed. I've seen it. Don't ask me where, but I've seen it. It's not that typical to see them. I mean, because inflation would make that thing because it pays the dividend that it pays, it's going to be punished because that inflation is going to show up in interest rates that markets use for discounting. Like right now, we're beginning to see an inflation premium being slid into interest rates, and it's a pretty severe one that it's going to show up. I was calling it last year that it would start to show up, and I was wrong by about 3/4 on when it would start to show up in the market, but that's a good point. Because that is not, that par value is not indexed to inflation, and because the market is going to start discounting with more of an inflation premium in their discount rates, what's going to happen is that preferred stock will begin to erode in value. And I bring up another point. Well, I should keep this for another lecture, but we had an insane inflation in the 1970s. By the late 1970s, it was just ludicrous. And you saw interest rates through the roof, especially after the Federal Reserve finally took control of the situation and clamped down the money supply. The expectation of inflation didn't go away right away, but the supply of money went down, so the price of money, interest rates, just went through the roof. You were talking about mortgage interest rates of 24%. You were talking about corporate bonds being issued at coupons of 30%, a 30% coupon. What was funny was it was just a few years ago that the last of those hyperinflation coupon bonds matured. The 30 years, oh, those things were selling at such premiums. You mean I'll get a 30% coupon if I buy that bond? Oh, those bonds were selling at insane premiums to par. But anyway, good question, though, because that's where I am almost wondering over the years if because of that experience that happened with preferred stock, that might have been what took the luster off putting it into fixed income portfolios. But I mean, that was so many years ago. They held, if that's the case, man, markets hold a grudge for a long time. Anyway, that is a way, that's one of our formulas right there. You can price stock. Now, there's an interesting variation on this formula. It's called the constant growth perpetuity. It is when it's an infinite stream and the growth of the dividend is, the growth rate is going to stay the same forever. This is a beauty because many companies, and you might remember I talked about this a little bit, many companies, if they're going to set up and start a dividend, and I said this to a lot of companies, well, think we should start giving a dividend? First of all, you need to make sure that you are committed to this because, one, if you start paying a dividend and then, oh, we're in bad times, let's stop paying a dividend, the market is going to spank you hard. Moreover, the market is going to expect that that dividend will grow in a predictable fashion. So not only if you decide you're going to start paying a dividend, you're in the program. And also, not just that, you're going to have to accept the fact that that dividend needs to keep growing year over year, forever. This is why you'll see companies like GE that are in financial trouble. They've got negative earnings. They're still paying their dividend, and they grew it because they know that the negative earnings is not going to irritate the market nearly as much as if they stop paying a dividend or even if they stop growing the dividend. So that stability of dividend. Now, some stocks, they just don't have a stability. But what we use, I'll show you a way that we can handle that. But if a company is going to pay a dividend and that dividend is going to grow at a constant rate, there's a twist on the perpetuity formula we can use to price common stock. Again, the common stock has to be paying a dividend and the dividend has to have a predictable constant growth rate. If those are the case, then the price value, the present value of the future expected cash flows are the current dividend grown one period. Now, sometimes you'll be given the one-year out dividend. So don't grow that. If they give you, well, the dividend next year is expected to be. So if they give you that, don't you do the D0. But if they give you the current dividend, you got to grow it one period at the growth rate over the market's discount rate minus the growth rate. If the company's stock is growing at a constant rate, stock dividend is growing at a constant rate. So, in other words, DNF common paid, just paid, a 25-cent annual dividend that is expected to grow for the foreseeable future at a rate of 5% per year. If the market is currently discounting DNF dividend cash flow dividends at 6.8%, what is the current price? Of DNF common. This is just a 240. I mean, you're learning this in 240, and we still use this formula for constant growth stocks to price them. Now, there are other really, really awesomely, mathematically, stupidly complicated ways that it's being done some places now. But, I mean, I wouldn't even try to show you that until you were in grad school. Most people who do the pricing and analyzing, even the programs that do the software, the financial engineering software, still uses this model to this day for constant growth dividend stocks. So what I would do here is, okay, they just paid this dividend, so the price right now should be, P0 should be, the current dividend, 25 cents per share, grown one period. So that's 1 plus 0.05. And again, if they told you the dividend that was going to be paid in a year, all you do is put that down. You don't grow it because it's already out there 1 year. I can't emphasize that enough. Divided by, where are we? 0.068 minus 0.05. And again, this is math, so this is a formula, so you use the decimals. Remember I told you in financial calculator apps, you always put in the percent? Well, here, this is the actual math, so arithmetic, so you got to use the percentages. Now, if I honk that thing out here, I would do 0.25 times 1.05 divided by, open parenthesis, 0.068 minus 0.05, close the parenthesis, equals $14.58 per share. Predicted it. That's a prediction. What I would do with this, and I'm being a little bit simplistic here, I would look at the current price. And if I saw a sufficient deviation, I would try to take advantage of it. Like if I saw that the price was marking, the ask was at, let's say, $14.50, if I'm sure of myself about the discount rate that I use, that 6.8%, I'd buy in. I'd buy for a quick in and then dump it as soon as the price found its legs back up to 1458. It's going to happen so fast. And those computers on those Wall Street boys' desks are going to be smelling things like this as just like instantaneously. So you got to move fast if you're going to pull a stunt like this off. On the bright side, and I think I talked about this, but I'm not sure I did. The markets like the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and all of that have an order entry system that will let small-time players get to the front of the line for a trade. We used to call it, in my time, it was called the SOS, Small Order Entry System, and now they've got these different names for it. But if it's a small order, you know, less than 10,000 shares or something like that, you can step in front of the big boys to do it. Now, rumor is that the big boys have figured this out pretty well. So what they do is they create these tiny accounts that are really shadows of their monster accounts. And then they step in and play the small order entry system to get to the front of the line. And because they move so fast, they'll get to the front of the line before you get to the front of the line. So there you are. Gives you an idea of just how much it sucks in this high technology world. But there is a possibility, and this is how we do it. I mean, if I were to do this, and there is a certain lack of responsibility in playing this, I look for real small-time stocks that the dinosaurs, the monsters, are not seeing because they're in such a low-level position. And I scan those, run the formulas, and then I see if there's any kind of arbitrage opportunity on the up or the downside. So it gives you an idea of a place where you can use this. Now, one thing that we do see that's rather common, rather not that unusual, we'll see a company that is not paying a regular dividend. It's paying like it did 40 cents and then it did 35 cents, then it did 50 cents. What we do with a problem like that to price it isn't that hard, but follow with me on this because I'm showing you one of the problems that you'll get in your assessments. Suppose that you're sitting right here at time zero looking at this company. Now, what we might see, and this is not that unusual, especially for younger companies, is that, let's say at period one, they're not going to pay any kind of a dividend. But then in period two, they pay a 5 cent per share dividend. Then in period three, they pay, let's say, an 8% dividend, 8 cent dividend, I should say. And it's just all over the place. 0 to 5, 5 to 8 cents is not a constant growth. But then something kind of magical happens. What we see is in their, let's say in one of their 10K filings, in the management discussion and analysis, they say that they expect that at year three, their dividends will become constant growth. At, let's say, 5% per year. So in other words, this dividend out here at period 5 is going to be 5% more than at period 4, and then it will have stable growth ever after that. The way we would play a stock to price it, we would just take the present value of each of these oddballs, the first 3 years of oddballs. And in fact, I would take the 10 cent at year four, just take its present value, add those up, just leave them alone, and then use the constant growth perpetuity formula here, which would find me the price of the stock at period four. In other words, here, the dividend, the price here, we are predicting that the price right here at period four should be 10 cents per share grown one period at 1 plus 0.05 divided by, let's say the discount rate is 9% on this stock, 0.09 minus 0.05. That would get us the price here at period 4. And then we just take that back as the present value and add it to those. Complicated at first, but it's not too bad. All you do is find the present value of the turbulent part, the crappy part. And once it stabilizes, then you can use your perpetuity formula. But you've got to bring it back because you're going to be pricing at the beginning of when the constant growth happens. If you are willing to do that, and I mean, this is, if you know Excel enough, you can put this together like real fast in an Excel spreadsheet for however long. Now, a lot of times we see tea leaves. We also see a lot of companies, they'll start their dividends, and we'll say, all right, companies like this, how long before they stabilize their dividends? And then we'll sort of take that as our rule of thumb on when we're going to see the dividends stabilize. Some companies pay the same dividend for like 5 years, and only in year 6 do they start a constant growth path. And why are they going to start a constant growth path? Because generally speaking, the boys on Wall Street will have them in for a nice, friendly talk, and they'll say, you need to stabilize your dividend. And if you do that, then you will, we'll start putting your stock into our investment fund considerations. And so they get pressure to find that stability. It's like you, madam. You're an insane person. You're a mad dog. You're crazy. I've seen some of the things, the antics. Like that time you climbed the Empire State Building and stood at the top of the tower and said, eh. Okay? And then the next year, what did you do? You used a jet ski to go across the Pacific, chased by sharks. Now, I know you're young. And I know that you will find your footing and be stable. By the time you're 30, you'll be looking at people who did the same things you are. You'll say, look at those irresponsible bastards. That's one of the enjoyments of being older, is you'll get to look back at things you did and criticize people who are still doing them. Okay? But when you are 20... let's say 27, and you're still doing ridiculous things. You did those really hot peppers. The Carolina Reaper is the big one now. I saw you in a YouTube video eating a Carolina Reaper and then clawing the wall. You actually clawed a brick wall and took it down. And then I take you aside. My good woman, it's time for you to stabilize your dividend growth rate. That's what happens. Usually we have this turbulent period, but we know it's going to stabilize or die one way or the other. But you see the idea there is that we can use this. It's not science perfect, but we do know that there's a predictability to companies' behavior. They'll have no dividends at first, then they'll have unstable dividends, and then they'll start to behave themselves later and have a straight-up dividend. Netflix right now has no dividend. I would speculate that there's going to be what we used to call a come-to-Jesus meeting with the executives of Netflix and the board of directors from the people up the road. Look, we've been buying your stock. We think you're a great company. Hell, you raise your fees and people just drool all over themselves. Almost 80% of your customers have seen everything that was interesting, and yet they still watch your Netflix stuff at night. So horrible. I wish I could do something else. But they still watch it. They never stop subscribing. We love your company. You've got to start paying a dividend, and you've got to stabilize it quickly. That'll be down the road a little ways. But there is going to be a meeting like that, I'm pretty sure. No, you don't just get to keep plowing your money, every penny of it, back into the company. You've got to show that you're a responsible, mature company at some point soon down the road. Anyway, that's where that comes in. I want to show you something now. These discount rates, do you see how I pulled that 9% out of the air? I pulled a discount rate, these 1.2, 1.5, 1.75 out of the air. There actually is method to that. Right now I'm pulling them without explaining anything about how you would actually get them. But we do know that markets tell us what the prevailing interest rate environment is. We can do back, we can actually back into calculations. The things that I did here, I can actually take the current price and back into what the market says the yield is. And I'll show you how to do that. It's not hard. As a matter of fact, it's a joy now compared to the way it used to be when you had to do it manually. But let me show you something here. I'm going to do something. Remember I showed you those how to find the yield on a treasury bill? And we can find yields on all kinds of investments. One thing would be the government, the treasury, and this is capitalized, treasury bills. There are the 3-month, 6-month, I can't remember whether it's a 9-month, it's a weird one. And then there is the 1 year. And treasury is capitalized here. Don't leave it uncapitalized when you're writing this on an exam for me. You'll lose a point because this is a proper noun. If you don't capitalize it, it could be any treasury of any company, anything. But if you capitalize it, it specifically refers to the government's official borrowings, the paper of the United States government. Those are the treasury bills. And then the treasury notes. Two-year, five-year, and seven-year. And then there are the treasury bonds. There is the 10-year, the 20-year, and the 30-year. Now, interestingly enough, the government had stopped issuing all debt instruments by the late 1990s because the government wasn't borrowing money. It was taking in more money than it was spending. And so the government just stopped borrowing, so there wasn't any of this paper anywhere around. It was just not there anymore. Interestingly, that just pissed off the Federal Reserve's chairman of the time, Alan Greenspan, because the way that the Federal Reserve has control over the economy is by lending the government money and then using that paper, those notes and bonds, to buy and sell with banks to modulate the supply of money and interest rates. When the Fed couldn't do it anymore because this stuff wasn't there, the Fed just started ranting and railing that there was a crisis coming, you know, horrors and horrors. Well, their prayers were answered when during the next administration that came in 2001, cut taxes insanely for the longest period up to that point in American history. Then we had a couple of nice wars, and we were back in deficit material, and the government started borrowing money again. That was just how the reality of it. It was a gambit, and all the things that we could have done with budget surpluses, paid down our national debt, gotten rid of it, funded free education from cradle to through PhD if you wanted it, turn to green energy, go into space and actually do it industrially, all that went away. And now you're holding on now to an insane new level of deficit that we were actually beginning to get it under control again until the tax cuts, and so you're wearing a whole lot of problems. Interestingly enough, Even when the deficit started accumulating again, the government wasn't issuing 30 years for a long time. I'll show you this in the next lecture, how this happens. But interest rates, on the longer the term of debt, the higher the interest rate is. All other things being equal, there's a maturity premium. And the maturity premium is larger the longer the term of the debt. It's just the way it is. Because the longer the term of the debt, the more vulnerable the debt security is to interest rate volatility. It's as simple as that. If I lend you, sir, money for a year at 10%, interest rates probably aren't going to go crazy over a year. But if I lend you that for 30 years, there's a lot of room for interest rates to swing up and down. And either way they swing, I, the lender, can get screwed. Here's why. Think about it this way. Madam, you are going to borrow money for a home. You're going to borrow at, let's say, 6% for 30 years. I'm the lender. Now, over 30 years, there's no question interest rates could move. What happens if mortgage interest rates drop to 4% while you own the home? Yeah, I understand. You're going to refi. I mean, if you're paying 6% and interest rates go to 4%, you're going to refinance on me. I, the lender, thought I was going to get 6% for 30 years, but you scoundrel, interest rates fell to 4%, so you're going to refinance with some bank at 4% and give me back my money, and I can't do anything but lend it at 4% when I was counting on 6%. So falling interest rates are going to wreck me. Now, the other thing is that most of the time, people have an average holding period for one home of about 7 years before they buy another one. What happens if you got a loan at 6% and interest rates skyrocket to, let's say, 12% on mortgages? Are you going to sell that home and buy a new home paying a mortgage interest rate of 12%, or are you going to hold on to your 6%? You better believe you're going to hold on to that 6. I don't care if now you've got 7 kids and your brother, who is ne'er-do-well, has moved in, and then he brought in his family and they're using the garage for something where they come out with these funny gas masks on. I mean, you'll still hold on to that house. You were planning to sell it, not tell him or your kids where you moved. But you're going to have to hold on to it because interest rates have gone up. So either way, I'm the lender. Oh, I'd love to have you get rid of that mortgage so I could reinvest the money at 12% in 7 years. Nope, you're going to hold on to that darned loan at 6%. So no matter which way interest rates go, the longer the time period the loan hangs out there, the more likely I'm going to get bombed by that lending instrument. Short, not much maturity premium. The longer, the worse the maturity premium gets. That's just how it is. And if I, as a lender, I'm going to put a premium in there, I'm going to hang some extra interest in there for that risk that I'm taking. In an environment where I see interest rates being highly volatile over a period of time, the bigger that maturity premium will be at all lengths of loans. So with that in mind, I'm going to show you something here. It's called a yield curve. The yield curve plots the term of a government debt instrument against its yield. And I'll show you. And I'm going to show you something that is almost like a dark crystal ball. Will you quit it with that? I can never remember the name. The web address. Really? Okay. I I'm looking for one. It's Dynamic Charts, I think its name is. I can never. Dynamic Yield Curve. Okay, there it is. Okay, now. A normal yield curve has, remember, this is on the x-axis, on the horizontal axis, you will have the term of the instrument. In other words, it'll go from 3 months, 6 months, 1 year out this way. And it's oftentimes what's called a logarithmic x-axis. In other words, the space between a 0 to 3 month is about the same as from 20 to 30 years, so that you don't get this widely spread chart. The typical one, this would be for a three-monther right here, the shortest of the short, and that would be the yield on the three-month, the current yield on a three-month. And then the yields are plotted going out. Now, it's one of those things where I can't tell you what is exactly a healthy chart, but I can tell you an unhealthy chart. It should, in a healthy economy, have an upward slope because there's a maturity premium. It shouldn't have too much of an upward slope because that indicates a lot of concern about interest rate volatility and therefore a larger maturity. But it should not be too flat either. It is a healthy one, swings upward. It doesn't have a super high arch, and it doesn't have too much flatness to it. The one that is the danger, the one that has preceded every recession in American history since data was collected, is what's called an inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve has some place where a longer instrument has a lower yield than a shorter instrument. Back in 2008, in the spring, I was writing my website, and that was the one that got destroyed finally by malevolence, but I was writing that the yield curve was trying to invert. This was before the crash in September. The yield curve was just scary, and it was even flat from there. The 7 and the 10-year, the 10-year was trying to go in yield below the 7-year. And it just floated above it a couple of basis points. Just a couple, in other words, a basis point is 0.01%. Day over day, I was writing, I was posting, yield curve preparing to invert, yield curve, and it just wouldn't do it. And then one morning at about 10 a.m., and it was in June, it did a technical inversion for about an hour and a half. The 10-year yield went a little, just a couple of basis points below the 7-year, and I called it, that's an inverted yield curve, we'll have a recession. Now, not every inverted yield curve has led to a recession. Sometimes it leads only to an economic pause. But every recession that has actually happened has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. So as we get closer and closer to the inversion, we start to watch more carefully. Now, if you look at this yield curve right here, that's the one on the left here at stockcharts.com/treasurycharts/yieldcurves.php. You see how right here in the 5 to 7, see the 5 to 7? The 7 is still above the 5, but man, that son of a bitch is trying to pull in. Now, let me show you this. This is the cool one. In dynamic charts, you can see the yield curves. Out 6 months. See that the shadow there? That is what was happening. At the bottom would be what was happening before, at 6 months ago. Now, as we get closer and closer to the present, Look at the short end. Do you see the short end pulling upward? Do you see that? Again, let me take out six and bring you back to the present. You see that shadow as we get closer to the present? Look at how the short end is hiking up while the longer end isn't doing it. That's preparing for an inversion. Again, look at it again. Do you see how it's coming upward there at the short end? In fact, notice that it's there, that shadow right there. Do you see how it was there? And now we're getting this flattening there. But look at that. Look how it's flattening out. It's preparing for an inversion. Is it going to invert? I'm not going to tell you my prediction. But yeah, it is. You see it? Again, let me show you. Watch what's happening. That's a yield curve trying to get ready for an inversion. The five-year is coming up faster than the seven-year is. And so if it keeps that up, how long? 6 months, two quarters, three quarters is typical. I called that one actually kind of late because it just drove me crazy. I couldn't call a recession until I'd seen the actual inversion that morning. And then it went back to normal. The 10-year in that case got that afternoon above the 7-year, and then it would waver back and forth. But it didn't matter. Once it inverts, technically, that's it right there. And then on September 15th, and I'll tell you a quick story here, but keep this in mind. You are actually seeing one of our very few quite reliable forecasters of a recession. And I figure we'll probably be in the worst of the recession right about when you guys are out there trying to find jobs, careers. Okay, that was insensitive. Okay, now, let me tell you about 2008, really quick. On the morning of 2008, in September 15th of 2008, it began like a lot of mornings do, a lot of heavy trading in stocks and bonds. There was evidence, and I had been calling it, and a few other naysayers, bears, and conspiracy theorists have been calling for something really, really bad to happen. But, you know, we're on the fringe, people like me are. And so something odd at the Federal Reserve, they were noticing that in the early morning hours, there were really large withdrawals of money from the money markets, the cash. They were just pulling the money out. They weren't putting it into another part of a portfolio. Okay, well, they're scared. They're going for gold. Gold prices were not going up. So in other words, that money wasn't being pulled out of traditional investments in a flight to quality to gold or to silver or to whatever. That money was just going into a black hole. And we're not talking about billions. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars every 10, 30 minutes. The Fed saw that this was really a bad thing. I mean, seriously. Because if enough money was pulled out, you would have a collapse of the financial system. Because essentially it would be like a run on the banks. There would be no money in the banks to finance transactions in normal stocks and bonds and portfolios. It just wouldn't be there. Because, okay, at 10 o'clock, if I remember the numbers, $550 billion had been pulled. Where did it go? We still can't answer that question. It was just pulled out of the traditional banking and financial system. It was sucked out. The Federal Reserve grasped that at this rate, within a couple of hours, the entire financial system of the United States would collapse. That would mean that your debit card wouldn't work. Your paycheck in the bank, it would be gone. Your pension fund would be gone. It would all be gone in 2 hours. They suspended all withdrawals from money market accounts at about 10 a.m. They just stopped it. That's it. And again, that was about 2 hours before a global financial apocalypse that would have ended everything that you know. You would have had the usual stuff that I've seen in third world countries with gunmen running the streets and militias, looting and all that. And hardly anyone knew about it. There was Congress went into closed session. Marshals stood outside of the doors of the House of Representatives. In the chamber, one representative, kind of a right-wing conspiracy nut, but he asked a specific question of then-Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Madam, are we under martial law? She didn't answer him, but she also didn't unlock the doors until they found what was going on, what they could know about it. They were fortunately scared enough by what was being told to them by Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and by Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman. They were scared enough that they didn't even bitch about a $787 billion bailout package later to pull us out of the recession, and close to $15 trillion poured into the banks to fill in the massive sinkhole that was those 10 largest banks in the world. Let's hope that doesn't happen again, but I can't promise you it won't. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.